There we go. Well, good afternoon again. This is the second sermon in the series on the seven eras of the church, both in the Old Testament and in the New. I'd like to begin today over in the book of Judges, because the book of Judges gives us an account of one of the longest periods in the history of the church, in the history of the Old Testament church, that sometimes we read this book and don't realize that between Judges 1 and 1 Samuel 6, we have about 440 years of the chronological history of the church in the wilderness, or the church under the various judges. When these people were established across the river into the promised land that God gave them, each man was to be head of his family. They were to have Levites. They were to have Levitical cities. They were to have cities of refuge. And God was to be the God over each one of them. But as we find in this book, very soon after the leaders died or failed, very quickly they began to be embroiled in false doctrine and false teaching. In the book of Judges, really the summary of the book is in chapter 2. The summary of the book is not at the end. That concerns some inset stories or some other pithy points of history that may have occurred actually much earlier in the book chronologically. In Judges chapter 2, we find the angel of the Lord in verse 1 came to Gilgal to Bochim and said, I led you up from Egypt and brought you to the land which I swore to your fathers and said, I'll never break my covenant with you. You shall not make any covenant with the inhabitants of this land, but you shall tear down their altars, but you have not obeyed my voice. Why have you done this? So we have the people very quickly after the death of Joshua. And Joshua's death would mark the end of the first era of the Old Testament church, of the church in the wilderness. And now we have the second era beginning. In verse 8, Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died when he was 110 years old. They buried him within the border of his inheritance at Timnath-Heres in the mountains of Ephraim on the north side of Mount Gaish. But notice what happened. In this next part of the chapter is the summary of everything from the first part of Judges until about the 10th chapter of 1 Samuel. When all that generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord nor the work which he had done in Israel. So people forgot. They very quickly were influenced by the land around them, by the tribes around them, by the Canaanites. The children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. So they looked at the statues and the monuments and the places of worship that were in the land, and they forgot God and began to worship those statues, those false places of worship. They forsook the Lord God of their fathers who had brought them out of the land of Egypt, and they followed other gods from among the gods of the people who were around them. They bowed down to them, and they provoked the Lord to anger. So the history we have in the book of Judges can be summarized as repeatedly over and over and over this cycle of God delivering them out of trial and tribulation, and then they forsake God after a period of obedience. They then go after false idols. They begin living hedonistic lifestyles, and before long, God simply has to punish them again, and then they go through the cycle once again. Verse 13, they forsook the Lord and bowed down to Baal and Asheroth. The anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, so he delivered them into the hands of the plunderers who despoiled them. So God used the other nations that here he calls plunderers who despoiled them. He sold them into the hands of their enemies all around so that they could no longer stand before their enemies. Wherever they went out, the hand of the Lord was against them for calamity, as the Lord had said, and the Lord had sworn to them. They were greatly distressed. But notice what God did during this time of many cycles of disobedience, of the nation going into captivity, into apostates, into serving other nations and neighbors around them. Nevertheless, the Lord raised up judges who delivered them out of the hand of those who plundered them. But they would not listen to their judges. They played the harlot with other gods and bowed down to them. They turned quickly from the way in which their fathers walked in obeying the commandments of the Lord, and they did not do so. Now, the book of Judges, covering about 440 years, if you go from Judges chapter 2 until 1 Samuel chapter 10, there are 9 records of apostates going into idolatry. There are 7 records of Israel becoming servants of other nations. They're called 7 servitudes. And there are 14 judges and their exploits in Judges, and 2 more in the book of 1 Samuel. So altogether, 16 different judges are recorded here for us. And there are numerous records of divine chastening, of God coming into contact with these people and saying, sorry, you are not obeying me, and causing other nations then to rule over them and using them to bring them back to their senses. Verse 19, it came to pass when the judge was dead, they reverted and behaved more corruptly than their fathers by following other gods to serve them and bow down to them. They did not cease from their own doings or from their stubborn way. Then the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel. He said, because this nation has transgressed my covenant, which I commanded their fathers, and has not heeded my voice, I will also no longer drive out before them any of the nations which Joshua left when he died. So God said, no longer will I drive out the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Jebusites. I will leave them in the land for the purpose of, verse 22, that through them I might test Israel, whether they will keep the ways of the Lord to walk in them as their fathers kept or not. So these other nations were left as a type of a test or a trial for the people of Israel. Now there are several records that I think are interesting just as sort of a superficial jump. Let's go over to chapter 4 and verse 1. We have here the death of Ehud, one of the first judges. Ehud was dead. The children of Israel did again evil in the sight of the Lord. So when they had a righteous and a good judge, they seemed to do well and follow God. When he was dead, very quickly they went into idolatry. The Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. The commander of his army was Sisera, who dwelt in Harosheth Hagoyim. And the children of Israel cried to the Lord, for Jabin had 900 chariots of iron. That'd be a lot of chariots. The 900 is probably more than they had in the Ben-Hur movie. Certainly all lined up together would be quite a sight. And for 20 years, he harshly oppressed the children of Israel. So for 20 years, this Canaanite king oppressed the people of Israel. So God raised up Deborah, a prophetess, and of course, verse 15, the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army with the edge of the sword before Barak, who of course was working with Deborah. So we have in this case just one more of those examples in the book of Judges of God raising up a judge or a deliverer, and Israel does fine as long as that judge is alive, but as soon as that judge or that deliverer dies, they go right back into idolatry and apostasy. Over in chapter 6, tells us, well, actually the verse before chapter 6, the last verse in Judges chapter 5, says the land had rest for 40 years. This is after the Midianites were destroyed. I'm not sure the Midianites, but Sisera. But then the Midianites were next. The children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian for 7 years. And the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel because of the Midianites. The children of Israel made for themselves dens and caves and strongholds, which were in the mountains. As we read through this book, and keep in mind some of the accounts of the Smyrna church, the second church that we have recorded for us in Revelation chapter 2, we find some striking similarities. In the early church of Smyrna, which covers about the year 135 to 325, we had the death of Polycarp, of Polycrates, of those who were trying to hold fast during great times of religious doctrinal change. But what happened about the year 325, or about the time when this church of Smyrna was over? There was a council, the first Catholic council, at a place called what? Anyone know? Actually, it was Nice. Everybody says Nicaea, but it's called Nice, N-I-C-E, in southern France. I got that wrong until about 2 days ago. But in college, they kept telling us it was called the Nicene Council, and so people call it Nicaea, but it was never, there's no town called Nicaea. The town is called Nice in southern France. So, no big deal. The important thing is this. At the Council of Nice in about 324 AD, virtually every major heretical doctrine of the Catholic Church was solidified in stone. The doctrine of the Trinity, the doctrine of the immortality of the soul, of heaven and hell, of all of the basic doctrine, not keeping the Sabbath. It was illegal to keep the Sabbath. They had to keep Sunday. They had to keep Easter instead of Passover. In those intervening years, during this really less than 200 years, 190 years of the Church of Smyrna, the established doctrines of the recognized church went through complete change to where instead of keeping the Sabbath and the holy days and unclean foods and all of the doctrines that Jesus Christ taught and he and the disciples kept, we have emerging now in this council in 325 these completely different doctrines that are now not only accepted by the universal church, which has established itself in Rome as a result of Simon Magus, but we also have some very, very strange people doing it. Who was the author of the Trinity Doctrine as it is understood and taught today? A man from Alexandria, Egypt, lived in the 200s A.D., right up to the late 300s, early 300s, a guy named Origen. He was the origin of the Trinity Doctrine. And he also had a kind of a monastery down there in Alexandria from whence came most of the spurious copies of the Greek New Testament that we have today. And so he's caused a lot of confusion because many of those are in error. Anyone know what Origen is well known for in his personal life? Well, notice he castrated himself. He thought he was under too much temptation to sin, so he thought the way to do that is to get out your knife and do the old bull into a steer routine. I don't think most of us would agree that's the best way to deal with temptation, but that's what Origen is. He was the originator of the doctrine of the Trinity. And a number of others, other men, other people that we have in early church history, were also involved in that council at Nice, France, in 324. But that came at the very end of some very terrible years for the church. But what happened in the church itself is very murky, because at the end of the Ephesian era, we have Gnosticism and all sorts of doctrines that are at variance from the established truth coming into and working their way into the church. But we also have the seven different persecutions of the Roman Caesars against the church that began first, of course, with Nero and then continued through all of the other ones that came along after him, Vespasian and many of the others. So we have these various little persecutions from the outside, from the government, combined with heresy on the inside. And we had then at the very end of the Smyrna era an established Roman church, an established recognized church then by the world that was very much different than the doctrines established and left by Jesus Christ for his people. So what happened is the same thing as we have here in verse 2. Because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made for themselves dens and caves and strongholds in the mountains. At this point, at this last part of the Smyrna era, especially during the Diocletian 10 years of persecution, the true people of God ended up living in caves and living in places where nobody else wanted to live. There are under the cities of most major Roman Empire cities what they call catacombs. Anybody's ever been there or not, but they're basically kind of tunnels where they buried people, and I don't know if it was necessarily slave quarters. There are different stories about them, but they certainly buried a lot of people in there during the first century and second century A.D. And I've seen pictures of them. I've not been there. We hope to go to Italy this year for the feast, so we'll try to go see some of those. But the catacombs, by the way, were raided by the Crusaders when they came down and others, and all those bones magically became the bones of St. Paul or St. Peter, and they're now at all kinds of churches all over the continent of Europe. So most of those relics they have in those churches came from the Middle Ages, from people who went down to Rome and other places. Even Carthage, other places had underground catacombs, and they would go there, and obviously if it's a buried skeleton, it must be a saint, and then they took them back to their home church, and that's where they are today. So if you wonder how they got enough bones to make 24,000 skeletons, all of the bones of Peter, well, that's where they came from. But many people in the true church of God did end up living in mountains or in caves or in strongholds or perhaps in those catacombs, trying to escape the persecution they were going under. So we have in the book of Judges at least that similarity, that there was apostate teaching, that there was a servitude. They became servants. They did not become the dominant group. They became the servant group. They had some great exploits, but certainly they also had times when they were on the run and had to live in dens and caves and mountains. And the established doctrine, the established truth, was greatly changed by the end of the era of Smyrna. I want to go now over to 2 Corinthians chapter 2. 2 Corinthians chapter 2. We begin in verse 15. The word Smyrna means myrrh or perfume. It means a fragrant smell or a pleasant smell, somewhat like incense. So in 2 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 15, it says, "We are to God the fragrance of Christ among those who are being saved and among those who are perishing." So you might say, we are to God the Smyrna of Christ, the fragrance, the smell, among those who are being saved and among those who are perishing. So the Smyrna church, or at least the concept here, is that the followers of God are examples that are recognized by those who are being saved, those who have God's Spirit and are heading towards His kingdom, and among those who are perishing, people who do not. And they recognize that there is certainly something here. To the one, the aroma of death leading to death. To the other, the aroma of life leading to life. Now, that's a play on words, because if you are the fragrance of Christ in the world, sometimes that means you're leading to death, because many people got persecuted and martyred during that time, and perhaps many other times in history. So it's a death fragrance to some, but also the aroma leading to life, because it leads to the second life, or the life where the second death has no hold upon us. But this word, Smyrna, means perfume, and it has, at least in God's example to them, or in God's judgment of them, they were in many cases a pleasant aroma, because they were, during very difficult times, a number of individuals who held fast and will be in the first resurrection. Now, Smyrna, of course, let's turn over to the book of Revelation, chapter 2. Smyrna was about 40 miles north of Ephesus. It was there where Christians were often persecuted. Polycarp died there in about the year 156 A.D. It's interesting because Smyrna was destroyed by an earthquake in 178 A.D., much like Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 A.D. by the Romans. But here we have Smyrna being destroyed in 178, but later rebuilt. It was one of the few Asian cities that withstood the Mohammedan, the Turkish onslaughts during the last part of the 1400s. It finally fell. It's now the modern city of Izmir, one of Turkey's largest. And of course, the approximate period for the Smyrna church is 135 AD till about the year 325. So we have here this letter, which begins to this church that has some striking similarities to the letter of Judges, or the book of Judges, and what occurred to those people when they first came into the promised land, and then, of course, their leader, Joshua, died. We begin in verse, We begin in verse 8 of chapter 2. To the angel, or the messenger, the logos of the church, or angelos, I mean, of the church in Smyrna, write, "These things says the first and the last, who was dead and came to life." So Jesus Christ is saying, this message comes from the one who was there as the creator, and who will be there at the resurrection and at the final judgment. The one who was dead and came to life. Now it's important because these people were going through very, very difficult times. The persecutions began not long after the church was established. We had in Jerusalem first the beheading of James, the stoning of Stephen. Then later the Roman emperors, Roman Caesars, got into the act, began to persecute Christians in Rome in the 60s AD and all through the empire. Periodically, they would have organized persecutions for perhaps 5 or 6 years, and then there would be a let-up for a while, almost in the same cycles as we found in the book of Judges. But in Revelation chapter 1 and verse 11, I'm sorry, verse 8, let's say in verse 8 to begin with, Christ says, "I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end." The Greek equivalent of the Hebrew YHVH, which simply means eternal or always existed, the beginning and the end. So what's important is the message of that word, not how it's pronounced or how it sounds. Jesus Christ is the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, the one who is and was and who is to come. You know, the word eternal in our English language. And down in verse 11, again he says, "I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last." So Jesus Christ here emphasizes who is giving this message to the church at Smyrna. He repeats it over in Revelation chapter 22 and verse 13, again saying at the very end of the book, "I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning at the end." Remember how Genesis begins, "In the beginning was the Word," or "In the beginning God created the heaven and the earth." Book of John, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God, the same was in the beginning with God." So it's the same being who gave this message to Smyrna. "I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, the first and the last." So he's the one which was dead and is alive. That's a very difficult verse for people who have logged on to some of these crazy God ideas to deal with. Because if he was dead, he couldn't have been a phantom. He couldn't have been just some sort of a ethereal being or an image. He had to be a real person. if he was somehow walking around in hell or walking around in some third or fourth heaven or some other angelic place during that 3 days and three nights, then he wasn't really dead. He was aware and alive and somewhere else. So it says here very plainly, he was the one who was dead and came to life. So he was crucified and he came to life. Now he says, very, very important verse, I know your works. In other words, I am watching what has gone on during this time of Smyrna. Tribulation and poverty. But you are rich. So some of them are rich, but many were shipwrecked during this time. But God says he can see, I know your works, tribulation and poverty. I know the blasphemy of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are of the synagogue of Satan. Just hold your place there and go over to Romans chapter 2, verse 28. This is interesting that he knows the poverty of these people. He knows that they were in trouble, that during this time they were undergoing regular persecutions, regular times when the Roman government outlawed what they were doing. And then he says, there are some among you who say they are Jews and are not. In other words, false teachers among this church era. People who came in and taught false doctrines but said, oh, we are teachers of the Bible. We are Christians. We are true ministers. We are all these things. They claimed that. They claimed to be Jews when they were not. In Romans chapter 2 and verse 28, it says, he is not a Jew who is one outwardly. In other words, just saying you are a Jew or just saying you're descended from it or just saying you're a Christian, just claiming to be a follower of Christ doesn't cut the mustard, doesn't give evidence. Nor is circumcision that which is outward in the flesh. But he is a Jew who is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart. So a Jew is one who is circumcised in heart, in the spirit, not in the letter, whose praise is not from men, but from God. So a Jew then, or someone that says he's a Jew and is not, is someone who claims to be circumcised in the heart, to have the praise of God, but really he does not. And there are many of those even extant today. There are a number of examples, of course, in the book of Judges. I want to go back here to Judges chapter 18. We find here in the book of Judges that during these 400 years, the Levites, who should have been the spiritual leaders of that nation, very much turned aside from their calling, and they went different directions. At the end of the book, in the book of 1 Samuel, you have Eli, who was finally a priest. And Eli, of course, didn't control his children. So we have just evidence, and especially here in Judges, that the great responsibility that was given to the Levites and to the sons of Aaron was not carried out like it should be. So in Judges chapter 18, there was verse 14. The five men who had gone out to spy the country of Lachish, these are Danites, by the way, answered and said to their brethren, do you know that there are in these houses an ephod? The ephod is this breastplate that the priest is supposed to wear. Household idols, a carved image, and a molten image. So here there were all these idols, these carved images that were in this house. They turned aside, verse 15, and came to the house of the young Levite man, the house of Micah, that was his name, and greeted him. 600 men and their weapons of war. Should have been quite a sight for poor little Micah. Verse 17, the five men who had gone to spy out the land went up. Entering there, they took the carved image, the ephod, the household idols, and the molded image. And the priest stood at the entrance of the gate with the 600 men who were armed with weapons of war. And these went into Micah's house and took his image, an ephod, and household idols, and molded image. And the priest said, what are you doing? They said, be quiet, put your hand over your mouth, and come with us. Be a father and priest to us. Is it better for you to be a priest to the household of one man or to be a priest to a tribe and family in Israel? So the priest's heart was glad. He took the ephod, the household idols, the carved image, and his place among the people. So we have, obviously, a very errant teaching going on here by this man who should have held fast to what God taught. He had idols. He had ephod that probably was more in tune with demons than it was with God. He had little statues of some kind which God said they should not worship or have. Verse 27, they took the things that Micah had made and the priests who had belonged to him and went to Lachish, to people quiet and secure, and struck them. So we have just in this one chapter here in Judges an example of a man who claimed to be a Jew spiritually but was not. And so we know that he wasn't teaching what was right, but the people of Dan did not recognize it. The judges who were good, and there were a number of them, did great exploits during difficult times were men like Samson, Ehud, of course Deborah and Barak, then Gideon, Jephthah, and Samson. Jephthah is famous in the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, the faith chapter, for keeping his word, even though it was a very difficult thing for him to do, to make sure his daughter did not ever get married and have children. And of course, Samson. So we have in verse 9, I know your works. This is back in Revelation chapter 2, by the way. God understood their works. There were some good works done in Judges. There were some good works done in the Smyrna church. They did try to preach the gospel wherever they were persecuted and went to. But we find the real effort of preaching the gospel died out drastically, became just a small glimmer of what it was. Because as these people were on the run during the first century, running from all these various Roman persecutions, they were not able to preach the gospel and to have a focused effort like they should. And during this time, of course, was the Bar Kokhba revolt in Jerusalem, where Jerusalem was completely leveled and destroyed for the second time and pretty much made a wasteland and was never again allowed to be rebuilt, except the Romans rebuilt somewhat of it and called it Area Capitolina. But it replaced it only with Romans. No Jews were allowed to live there. And, of course, Christians were considered to be Jews at that time period. Verse 10, do not fear any of those things which you are about to suffer. So here we have people who are about to suffer something. Now, for those who would try to make the seven errors of Revelation into simply an allegory about any church at any time with profound lessons for all of us, this is a very difficult sentence because it implies the chronology and the passage of time. Don't fear any of those things that you are about to suffer. That doesn't apply in everybody's life at all time. It applies in time and history. So we have not only lessons for all of us, because indeed it says often, let he who has an ear hear what the Spirit says to the churches. So every one of these arrows contains powerful lessons for each one of us. But there also is plenty of internal evidence that it is a historical chronology in advance. And given what we know about the chronology of the seven arrows in the Old Testament, and the similarities between them, it simply makes sense, and what we have in history, it seems to dovetail fairly well, though obviously a lot of the history of the Middle Ages and just before that, the post-Roman Empire days, were lost. So we have in here, do not fear any of those things which you are about to suffer. Now, what were they about to suffer? Who knows what those persecutions brought on them? I didn't bring my Fox's Book of Martyrs today because Fox's Book of Martyrs contains a great deal of information about this time period, and certainly it would be good for you to read it at your earliest convenience. But Christians were thrown to the lions. They were used for entertainment. They were sometimes rounded up and burned to death. Many were crucified. The Roman emperors seemed to try to blame the Christians, and sometimes the Jews, but especially the Christians, for whatever might have gone wrong during their reign or during the time when they were in charge. Now, the last and the final of the seven persecutions that we have record of was by a military governor who became Caesar named Diocletian. First, I want to turn over here to, let's go to James chapter 1 and verse 12. It's the closest. James chapter 1 and verse 12. There's a purpose for the persecutions they went through, just like there was a purpose when God allowed the neighboring nations to control the land of Israel and subject the Israelites back in the time of the judges. The purpose was to get people to recognize the important things they were called for. In the time of the Roman Empire, of course, there was pretty much peace throughout the world called the Pax Romana, but there was religious persecution because the emperors were trying to enforce their religion. And many, unfortunately, who were Christians, decided it was easier to accommodate the Roman religion or the Greek religion around them than it was to try to hold fast and fight. In Genesis, or James chapter 1 and verse 12 says, blessed is the man who endures temptation, or who endures chastisement, who endures what God allows to happen. Now, we don't normally look at it that way. We always say, well, you know, why is this happening to me? I don't like this. We don't want to go through these things. So instead of enduring or learning from, sometimes we try to run from it. When he has been approved, when he has gone through the test correctly and done things right and been approved by God, he will receive the crown of life, which the Lord has promised to those who love him. Now let's go over to Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 8, just back one book. Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 8 is a very profound verse about how Jesus Christ also learned, or at least went through this suffering, but he also learned what obedience was like from a human standpoint. Verse 7 of Hebrews chapter 5 says, "Who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with vehement cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death, and was heard because of his godly fear." So Jesus Christ's prayer was heard. "Though he was a son, yet he learned obedience by the things which he suffered." So though we are Christians, though we are following in the footsteps of Jesus Christ, we still might need to learn obedience by the things we have to endure, as it says here, some of the things that which you are about to suffer. Now let me read some history about Diocletian. And he was the one who instituted the 10 years of terrible persecution upon the church, murdering thousands upon thousands of people, some being burned, some being thrown to lions. It began in 303 and lasted until the year 313, only about 10 years before the Council of Nice. As Emperor Diocletian was faced with many problems, his most immediate concerns were to bring the mutinous and increasingly barbarized Roman armies back under control and make the frontiers once again secure from invasion. His long-term goals were to restore effective government and economic prosperity to the empire. Diocletian concluded that stern measures were necessary if these problems were to be solved. He felt that it was the responsibility of the imperial government to take whatever steps were necessary, no matter how harsh or innovative, and bring back the empire under control. Diocletian was able to bring the army back under control by making several changes. He subdivided the roughly 50 existing provinces into approximately 100. The provinces also were apportioned among 12 dioceses, each under a vicar. The latter also among 4 prefectures, each under a praetorian prefect. Sounds kind of like the image of the beast mentioned in the Revelation about how the organizational structure is set up. As a result, the imperial bureaucracy became increasingly bloated. He institutionalized the policy of separating civil and military careers. He divided the army itself into so-called border troops, actually an ineffective citizen militia, and palace troops, the real field army, which was led by the emperor in person. Following the precedent of Aurelian from 270 to 275, Diocletian transformed the emperorship into an out-and-out oriental monarchy. Access to him became restricted, and he now was addressed not as first citizen, but he was called Lord and Master, which is in Latin Dominus Noster. Those in the audience were required to prostrate themselves on the ground before him. Diocletian also concluded that the empire was too large and complex to be ruled by a single emperor. Therefore, in order to provide an imperial presence throughout the empire, he introduced the Tetrarchy, or rule by four. In 285, he named his lieutenant Maximinus Caesar and assigned him the western half of the empire. This practice began the process which would culminate in the de facto split of the empire in 395. Both Diocletian and Maximinus adopted divine attributes. Diocletian was identified with Jupiter and Maximinus with Hercules. In 286, Diocletian promoted Maximinus to the rank of Augustus, senior emperor, and in 293, he appointed 2 new Caesars, Constantinius, the father of Constantine I, who was given Gaul and Britain in the west, and Galerius, who was assigned to the Balkans in the east. By instituting this tetrarchy, Diocletian also helped to solve another problem. In the Augustan Principate, there had been no constitutional method for the choosing of new emperors. According to Diocletian's plan, the successor of each Augustus would be the respective Caesar, who would then name a new Caesar. Initially, the tetrarchy operated smoothly and effectively. Once the army was under control, Diocletian could turn his attention to other problems. The borders were restored and strengthened. In the early years of his reign, Diocletian and his subordinates were able to defeat foreign armies, such as the Alemanni, known today as the Germans, the Sarmatians, the Saracens, the Franks, and Persians, to put down rebellions in Britain and Egypt. Another problem was the economy, which was in especially sorry state. The coinage had become so debased as to be virtually worthless. Diocletian's attempt to reissue gold and silver coins failed because there simply was not enough gold and silver available to restore the currency. A maximum price edict issued in 301 intended to curb inflation, but served only to drive goods onto the black market. So they had price controls and inflation back then. Diocletian finally accepted the ruin of the money economy and revised a tax system that was based on payments in kind. In order to assure the long-term survival of the empire, Diocletian identified certain occupations which he felt would have to be performed. These were known as compulsory services. They included such occupations as soldiers, bakers, members of town councils, and tenant farmers. These functions became hereditary, and those engaging in them were inhibited from changing their careers. Diocletian attempted to use the state religion as a unifying element. Encouraged by Caesar Galerius, Diocletian in 303 issued a series of four increasingly harsh decrees designed to compel Christians to take part in the imperial cult, the traditional means by which allegiance was pledged to the empire. This began the so-called Great Persecution. So Emperor Diocletian, when he became emperor, inherited a Roman empire that was coming apart in various factions. They had diversity long before it was popular here. And he realized that the nation was coming apart, its army was coming apart, its economy was a mess, various regions were in conflict with each other. So he had all of these unifying strategies, and one of them was to make sure that everyone worshipped him as the emperor. And because the Christians would not, he issued these four decrees that were carried on later by Galerius, resulted in the deaths of thousands upon thousands of Christians. So when God said, "Fear none of those things which you are about to suffer," God knew ahead of time what would happen during that second era of the church. That there would be a tremendous persecution. In fact, there would be seven, pretty much each one a little worse than the previous ones, finally culminating in these terrible 10 days. Verse 10 again of Revelation chapter 2. "Don't fear any of those things which you are about to suffer." Now that could be applied to any of us, because there are times in our life when we are going to be suffering for Jesus Christ. That's just the way it is. He said, if they have loved me, they'll love you. If the world loves me, it will love you. All of those things that we know, we hear about every year at Passover. "Indeed, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison." Now, the devil in this case is Caesar, because Caesar is the one that threw them into prison. But keep in mind that the beast in Revelation 13 gets its power from the great serpent. So in this case, the devil is simply Caesar, the head of the Roman Empire. "And he indeed casted some of them into prison. Notice that you may be tested, and you will have tribulation for 10 days. Now you wonder about this 10 days of tribulation, that obviously a day per year in prophecy. We know that it was a time of 10 years of church members being on the run, of many, many of those who were teaching false doctrines, joining with the Catholic or the Roman system, the system of the Samaritan church established in Rome, and they became the dominant. They accepted the notary church. The real people of God had to scatter to the hills and to the mountains and places where they could survive. But you wonder about the lessons that we can all learn from this tribulation of 10 days. Now, have there been other tribulations of 10 days or of 10 years that maybe we could all take some lessons from? Well, if I think about my very short life of almost 50 years, the worst 10 years of my life were 1991 to the year 2000. Anybody might agree with that. In 1991, when I realized that the church I'd given my life for had been taken over by heretics, and my wife would vouch that I was one of the first ones to stand up. I was at a meeting of church ministers, I think in 1992. Now, what did I say? I was at lunch, and I said, "Hip, hip, hooray, hooray, we all believe in the Trinity," or something like that. But it was basically, we all believe in Trinity. It was the very first, letter that came out. And of course, all of them around the table said, "Oh no, we would never do that. Oh no, we would, Mr. DeCosh would never do that. Oh no, that would never happen." And so, a few years later, most of those guys called me back and said, "You know what? You were right." One of the few times in my life when I've been right, but certainly in that case I was. But from 1991 until the year 2000, the church was on the run. The people who wanted to obey God and His commandments, keep His Sabbath, tithing, believe in the kingdom of God, believe in the true nature of God the Father and the Son, Jesus Christ, were basically cast into prison or cast out or tested to find out whether or not we really believed what we had lived outwardly. So maybe there's a biblical example of those 10 days, of those 10 years, and certainly the years of 1990 or 91 until the year 2000. Another real close minister friend, in fact, it was Rick Stafford, called me at the end of 2000. He just said, "Hasn't this been an awful year?" He said, "Everything that could go wrong this year has gone wrong." He said, "It's just been an awful year for everybody he knew, not only their own job situations, their family situations, the things that took place in the organized church and the scattered thing." He just said, "This has been an awful year." In fact, I said, "Well, it's been an awful 10 years. He said, "Yeah, maybe so. Maybe God will give us a respite now." And we have had a time of peace and respite for the last few years, and I hope that it continues. I don't think it'll last forever because there are more prophesied challenges and tribulations ahead. But we cannot think we are different than the church at Smyrna, because we also have had some of the same experiences, even though ours might be a little more closer to one of the later church eras. But notice what he says at the end of verse 10. "Be you faithful until death, and I will give you the crown of life." So the lesson of Smyrna and the lesson of the judges, the time of the judges, is that even when there is organizational distress, when idolatry is being forced upon people, when the devil is casting people into prison, all you can control is your own faithfulness. You can't control anybody else's. But God says, "Be you faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life." And certainly we have many in our past history who have trodden that path as an example for us. Let's go back to Romans chapter 5 and verse 3. Romans chapter 5 and verse 3. Now the Smyrna church ended up, well actually with Ephesus and Smyrna, had seven different Roman-enforced persecutions. Roman emperor-enforced or initiated persecutions. We haven't had that many. But maybe there's another one waiting. When the time when the beast power comes and begins to persecute the saints of God and to enforce the mark of the beast. Romans chapter 5 and verse 3, he says, "Not only that we also glory in tribulations, knowing that tribulations or challenges produce perseverance." It takes perseverance to hold on to your faith, to hold on to what you know is true. And perseverance, character. The perseverance to do what is right develops character. In the final analysis, that's really all that matters, is your character, which is having the knowledge of what is right and always doing what is right, no matter what circumstances might be around you. And the character hope. Now, people who have character have hope. And if there's one thing that the world around us lacks, it's hope. And the reason is because they lack character. If you look at the entertainment industry, which is the most obvious culprit because they've done so much damage, they've been such a terrible influence upon the last two generations. But if all they live for is fun and pleasure, just having more fun, having more toys, having more whatever exciting experiences, what is the final end? The final end is hopelessness. Because everybody dies the same way they're born. Equal. Every little baby comes into the earth, basically a little kind of, you know, red crinkled skin, eyes closed, you know, crying, completely dependent upon its mother to take care of it. When you die, you simply go back to dust like Adam. Dust to dust, dust we are, and dust we shall return. People who live simply for hedonism, for pleasure, for having things, not one person I know of has taken anything with them to the next life. You know, people have been buried in their famous cars or in their favorite cars. I've heard a story back when I grew up of a lady who was buried with a big, huge diamond ring on her finger. And, of course, someone dug her coffin up and took it. So I think it's illegal now to be buried with a lot of jewelry on you. I don't know why you would do that anyway, but you know, I'm not an Egyptian pharaoh, so I wouldn't know. But at any rate, when we don't have character, that results in not having any hope. And we can't have character unless we first persevere, and you can't persevere unless you first have a trial, have a challenge. And God has always had in place Gentile nations, Canaanites, or adverse governments in order to create tribulation so he finds out where each one of us stands. So the Smyrna church, many of them did in their tribulation produce perseverance, and that perseverance produced character, and that character then resulted in hope. And then he said to them, "Be faithful until death, and I will give you a crown of life." It's really important that we have that example and never let it out of our heart, out of our mind. I want to go over now to Revelation chapter 20 and verse 6. Because the church at Smyrna was told that they would not be hurt by the second death. Not the first. Many of them were hurt by the first death. Many of them did go into some sort of a tribulation or some sort of some pretty terrible things. They went into some dens of lions. They went into sometimes being beaten or crucified, being chased in and out. They were really a church that was on the run. And in history, I would guess the total number of church members at the beginning of Smyrna was far higher than at the end, 200 years later. Revelation 20 and verse 6 simply says, "Blessed and holy is he who has part in the first resurrection. Over such the second death has no power." That's what really matters, is the second death. The first doesn't matter. It's appointed a man wants to die, and none of us wants to welcome death. But in the final analysis, the first death isn't going to matter. But those that overcome the second death shall be priests of God in Christ and reign with him 1,000 years. It's something that gave the Smyrna church hope and should give each one of us hope also as we look at the time when we will be hopefully in that resurrection, or at least heading towards the time we can be with Christ there. Let's go over to 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 12. Here he's simply talking, Peter is, to maybe some people who lived on into the next era of the church, on into the Smyrna era. You know, what did they have on their mind? If they had the book of 1 Peter, they might have read this in verse 12. "Beloved, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial which has come to try you." We have a dread disease or a fiery trial. Our first reaction is to always say, "Why me? You know, why does this have to happen to me?" As if it's some strange or odd thing. We've all said those words. I could ask for a show of hands, but most of us would raise our hand. So it's not strange when we have a trial or a challenge. It's not strange to the people at Smyrna when the Roman emperor once again, time and time again, issued edicts to persecute them, to have them, well, I think one of the edicts said they had to actually take a thing of salt, a handful of salt, and wave it over a bust of the emperor and say some sort of I guess it was a flame burning in front of a bust of the emperor, and say some sort of chant about how Caesar was, you know, the God above all gods or the supreme God of heaven or whatever. And if they wouldn't do that, then of course they were tortured or put in prison or beaten or starved to death or something like that. So there was a little ceremony that some of the edicts said they had to go through in order to be a part of the Roman Empire. Otherwise, they were subject to persecution. So to go through it over and over like they did during their 200 years would have been very, very difficult. But it says here, "Don't think it strange concerning the fiery trial which has come to try you, though some strange thing happened to you. Rejoice to the extent that you partake of Christ's sufferings, that when his glory is revealed, you may also be glad with exceeding joy." What kept them going, and what will keep us going, is if we keep in mind that vision of what it will be like when his glory is revealed, because it says there, we'll be glad with exceeding joy. I don't know if we've ever had exceeding joy before. Maybe when when your children are born, or when your children do good, or when your wife tells you you look nice, or your husband tells you you look nice, whatever. But I would think in this life, physically, we have not ever experienced exceeding joy as will be experienced then, because we don't have the capacity as physical people to have that kind of joy. But it's coming if we do our part. Verse 14, "If you are reproached for the name of Christ, blessed are you." This is a lesson of Smyrna, that if we have ears to hear what the Spirit says to the churches, certainly applies to us. For the Spirit of glory and of God rests upon you. On their part he is blasphemed, but on your part he is glorified. And why is that? Verse 17, "The time has come for judgment to begin at the house of God." If we are now being judged or tested, the only way you can test something is to put it under a little bit of stress, to see how it's going to work, to see how it's going to function when the actual time comes for it to be used. People who are engineers and contractors always stress concrete. They have stress tests for steel, stress tests for virtually everything that goes into a building, because they have to know, will it stand up to the stress of the weight or the earthquake or the shift or whatever it might be, the compression factor. So God does the same with us. He has to know inside and out, just like he knew with Abraham, you know, "Now I know that you will follow me no matter what, and you'll teach your children to follow me no matter what." He says, if it begins first with us, What will be the end of those who do not obey the gospel? So there is an end of those who do not obey the gospel, an end of those who do not understand and have not yet gone through the time when they have had their test. There will come a time when they will. There will come a time when there will be a test for everyone, but it isn't there yet. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 5. Last week and today, we can empathize and sympathize with those who are suffering, with those who are going through the things that the Smyrna church did, because God said He knew their works and how patient they were in times of tribulation. Well, the problem in Smyrna was heresy. It was false teachings that were infiltrating the church. That was an internal problem for 200 years, actually more than that. The second challenge was the outside influence of the Roman government and the persecutions. Perhaps they wouldn't have needed or wouldn't have been subjected to all the various persecutions had they held fast better than they did. We don't know. We can't judge that. All we know is that the end result of their persecutions and the things that happened to them was that many of them did qualify for God's kingdom. And they were then also at the end almost unrecognizable by the world, because the world then adopted a completely different form of Christianity and ensconced that in a church of Europe that has become the recognized doctrines and teaching ever since. In Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 5, have you forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as sons? My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord. Don't be discouraged when you're rebuked by Him. In other words, have hope. For whom the Lord loves, He chastens, and scourges every son that He receives. If you endure chastening, God deals with you as sons. For what son is there whom the Father does not chasten? If you are without chastening, of which you've all become partakers, then you are illegitimate and not really sons. So indeed we have a blessing if God puts His hand to find out just how well we are doing and how well we're going to stand up for the things that we know we have said we're going to. Verse 11, no chastening seems to be joyful for the present, but painful. Nevertheless, afterward, it yields a fruitable or peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained or strengthened by it. So we are told very plainly in Hebrews the purpose of what these people went through as an example, because certainly they were not the only ones in history that are example to all of us. Now let's go back to chapter 2 of Revelation and finish the 11th verse. By the way, the message to Smyrna is the shortest of all the messages to the churches. It is the shortest. This church this name means fragrance or perfume, pleasant smell. It's a pleasant fragrance to God when the man who is the first and the last sees people who, despite all their tribulation and poverty, are still strengthening themselves. And they know the blasphemy of those who say they are Jews but are not, because the synagogue of Satan, the false teaching that comes into the church on a regular basis in cycles, was extant at that time and, of course, even has been in ours. Verse 11 says, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. So it's an admonishment for everyone to acknowledge this lesson of this church era. And perhaps we could include in that the lessons of the book of Judges, when there was no king in Israel, which means there was no God. God was to be their king, but since they didn't acknowledge God, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. They didn't do what was right in God's eyes because they had rejected God as being king. There was no man that was king, but there also was no God who was acknowledged by everyone as being king. So we have a time when, you know, God uses those things to test us. He says, he who overcomes shall not be hurt by the second death. So we're warned here in verse 11. He who overcomes, better listen to what the Spirit says to the churches, because you will then not be hurt by the second death. The purpose of Smyrna, and perhaps the example of Judges, so that we could all learn to overcome even during times of great difficulty. I want to end today over in Psalm chapter 30. Psalm chapter 30. This is not some new concept that was introduced in the book of Revelation. In fact, it's all through the Scriptures. But in Psalm chapter 30, David simply talked about, and the psalm here was a dedication of the house of David, so a dedication of his place that he was going to live. He says in verse 5, his anger is but for a moment, but his favor is for life. So when we have challenges, when there are trials like went through, the church of Smyrna went through for 10 years and many earlier years before that, keep in mind that it's temporary. But God's favor is for life. It's for eternity. Weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning. So joy comes in the morning. The exciting thing about the Smyrna church is that despite that very, very difficult time in church history, when many lost their life, when many turned over to heresy, there were still quite a number who held fast, just like we have to do, no matter what happened. And God says they will avoid the second death and, in fact, be in the first resurrection. So in a sense, that's the same thing as saying what it says here, that weeping may endure for a time or for a night, but in reality, if we hold fast like many in Smyrna, then for us also, joy will come in the morning. Mr. Gunnarsson can lead us in one more song, and then we'll have a closing prayer and blessing the food, and then the potluck.